Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price, and I am joined by Chad Bird alone today. How you doing, Chad?
I'm good. Here we are. Just the two of us. We'll fill in for Brandon today.
Okay. Let's do this thing. Do you know where we're at? Do you recall?
I do. Actually, the only reason I recall is because I wrote it down. My memory is growing weak, so I have to write everything down these days.
Yes.
We are in chapter 41, about halfway through, verse 37 is where we're gonna pick up today.
All right.
So we left everybody hanging last time, if I remember correctly. So unless they read ahead, they don't know. They've been waiting with anticipation to find out what happens in this next chapter of Joseph's life. So let's recap where we left him. So Joseph has been in prison for a while, and then he interpreted the two dreams of the cupbearer and the wine guy, and nothing happened after that. Even though the cupbearer was supposed to say a good word on his behalf to Pharaoh. So he waits 2 years. Pharaoh has his dreams, and no one can interpret them. And it's then that the cupbearer says, "Hey, there was a guy in prison, a Hebrew, who is a pretty good dream interpreter." So they get Joseph out of prison. They clean him up, shave him, put on clean clothes. And Pharaoh tells him his dreams. Joseph interprets those dreams for Pharaoh. If you remember, the two dreams are basically the same dream, just told in different ways, that there is going to be 7 years of fatness in the land, followed by 7 years of famine in the land. So that's kind of where we left off. Joseph interprets the dreams, and then he hastens to add that Pharaoh should do a couple of things. He should first of all find someone who's really smart, who's a good planner, and they should put him in a position of power so that this really smart guy can set aside a lot of food during the 7 years, and then when the 7 years of famine come, they'll be ready. So that's kind of where we left off. And the next verse, verse 37 of chapter 41 says, "Now the proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and all his servants." So they like what Joseph says. And then Pharaoh gives the only reasonable answer that he can. He says, "Can we find a man like this in whom is a divine spirit?" So he says to Joseph, "Since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and according to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne I will be greater than you." And then he adds, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." So Joseph's life is about to go through another radical change, except finally, things are actually going to turn out well for him. He's been on pretty much a downward spiral ever since the age of 17, when he was sold into slavery by his brothers. And 13 years have passed. Now he's 30 years old, as we learn a little bit later in the chapter. So he's sold into slavery, taken into Potiphar's house, where he's accused of attempted rape, ends up in prison. And now he's about to enter into kind of the third phase of his Egyptian pilgrimage. First as a slave, then as a prisoner, and then he's exalted all the way to the right hand of Pharaoh. So this kind of going off of what Luther said, which I quoted in the last episode, this is Easter Day for Joseph. This is the day of his resurrection. So he went through this long, long passion week of suffering and crucifixion and burial. And finally, it's come to an end and he's exalted. He's enlivened. He's raised up from the pit of death, and he's exalted to the right hand of Pharaoh. So this is kind of a type of foreshadowing of the resurrection of our Lord, as Luther sees it, quite rightly. This is kind of a, in black and white, if you will, the black and white story that we see in full color of our Lord's own suffering and death and burial and resurrection. So this and this is, you know, this is just the way God works. He wounds and he heals. He kills and he makes alive. He buries, he resurrects. This is just simply the pattern that we see throughout the Old Testament that culminates in the life of Christ. It's a pattern that we see in our own lives as well, because God is constantly putting us to death in various ways and resurrecting us as well. This is the bearing of the cross that Joseph endured and that all God's children endured. This is simply always the way that God works. The Christian life is not a victorious life. Instead, it's a death and resurrection life over and over and over again as we're joined to Christ in his own death and resurrection. So here's Joseph. He's at Pharaoh's right hand, and we have kind of a long description of how much authority that Joseph has. He's kind of the as they say in some countries, the vizier, or maybe the prime minister, or as I like to call him, he's the vice pharaoh. So he's the one who has all authority in the land directly under Pharaoh. So he puts his signet ring on Joseph's hand, and he clothes him in garments of linen, puts his gold necklace around his neck. He has him ride in his second chariot. So he's in the second limo as they're parading around the country. And everywhere they go, they make this proclamation before him to bow the knee. And he goes all over the land of Egypt. So now Joseph is the vice pharaoh. He's got all this authority. So he's got a new job, basically. And he's about to get two new things as well. Not only does he have a new job, he's about to get a new name. This is kind of part of the Egyptification, if you will, of Joseph. So he's exalted to Pharaoh's right hand, and now he's given an Egyptian name. He's called Zaphnath-Paneah. That's the only time this name occurs in the Bible. We assume that this is the name that the Egyptians used to refer to Joseph, since Joseph would have been a Hebrew name. So he's called Zaphnath-Paneah. So he has a new job and a new name, and he's about to get a wife. So he's in a new relationship too. He's given Asenath, and she is the daughter of Potipharah, not to be confused with Potiphar, his master back in the day. This is Potipharah with an A on the end, who was a priest in the city of Heliopolis, or the city of On, O-N. Which is a major city in the ancient world along the Nile River. So new name, new job, new wife, everything about Egypt. It's like Joseph is being transformed within a few verses from a Hebrew son and brother into a full-fledged Egyptian ruler. He's vice pharaoh, has an Egyptian name, has an Egyptian wife, and he's basically the one who's in charge of all the land.
There's got to be an element of a pharaoh being like, I'm going to make this guy sort of second in charge here. He's second in command. But I'm going to need to like Egyptify this guy as much as possible if anyone's going to listen to him. So we'll give him a different name. We'll marry him in. In fact, we'll marry him off to this religious leader's daughter, which will help. So if his wife is the daughter of this sort of religious figure, then people will think, he's obviously in.
Yeah, I suspect it was those kind of considerations that led Pharaoh to do that. I mean, Joseph has to have credibility. Because there's about to be some pretty major changes that take place in Egyptian politics and law, because Joseph is going to be basically taxing the people pretty heavily over the next 7 years. Even though they have abundance of crops, he's going to be taking quite a bit of those crops from them and setting them aside. And, you know, this guy comes out of nowhere, right? Nobody's heard of Joseph. But all of a sudden, this new face is second in command. So yeah, he's got to make him look like he is one of them. He's got to look like an Egyptian, have an Egyptian name, have an Egyptian wife, be kind of part of the nobility, if you will, nobility of Egypt. And, you know, you got to wonder, too, what this does to Joseph. And maybe there's a hint of it in these next few verses when we get to talk about his two sons. But yeah, everything is changed. This is like a really is like a resurrection for Joseph. It's like a new life for him. Everything about his former life is gone. He has no family. He's basically an orphan. He has no family, no real cultural identity there. Even though he still believes in Yahweh, the true God, he's surrounded by all kinds of Egyptian deities. So there's got to be some culture shock that goes on with Joseph, and just a complete absorption into these new ways of Egypt. So he's a busy man with the new job, new marriage, and all of that comes the responsibilities that are part of the reason he was exalted to this position. They got to get ready for the famine that's coming. So for the next 7 years, they store up grain in all the cities of Egypt. In fact, there's so much, it says in verse 49, that Joseph stored up grain in great abundance like the sand of the sea until he stopped measuring it because it was beyond measure. So you kind of wonder what the people are thinking too. Why is he taking so much grain? But Joseph knows, and so he's getting ready for it. Then we have this added, and this I think is interesting. It tells us a little bit more about what's going on in Joseph's mind, because it says that the year before the famine came, so this would have been about, you know, we'll say 6 years, 6 years or so into his marriage. Before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. The first one he names Manasseh. And he explains the name this way. He says, "Because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household." We'll come back to that in a second, but let's get to the second one too. Then he had a second son, and he named him Ephraim, or Ephraim. "For," he said, "God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction." So his firstborn is Manasseh. Manasseh comes from a Hebrew verb, nasa, which means to forget. And the particular form of this Hebrew verb, it's called hifil. It's usually translated as something like cause something to happen, make something to happen. In this case, it's causing to forget. So he explains the name this way. He said, "I'm going to name this my firstborn son. I'm going to name him Manasseh because God has made me or enabled me to forget all my trouble and all my father's household."
You know, it's weird, but I hate to say boo on this, but...
Go ahead, say boo.
You don't name somebody after something you've forgotten. That doesn't make sense.
Because that person becomes a constant remembrance, right?
And if you had really forgotten, it wouldn't occur to you to name them that. You sort of like let the cat out of the bag, like... "I'm gonna name my kid Manasseh because I don't even remember my father's house that I just referenced."
Right, exactly. Yeah, this if there's any forgetting that's going on, perhaps it's sort of an emotional forgetfulness. The way I see it is this. Yeah, first of all, he remembers, of course he remembers, otherwise he wouldn't name his son that. But either he's at the point.
It actually has to still bother you or you don't name your son that.
Yeah. So either he has come to the point of some sort of emotional healing, emotional forgetfulness, if you will. Or the whole thing is nothing more than self-deception.
Dude, it's like if I had named my daughter after like an ex-girlfriend because I'm so over her.
Yeah.
Like, nobody believes that.
Nobody believes, yeah. The only person who believes that is you, and you really don't believe it, right? So it's all nothing more than an act of the self-deception. It becomes obvious that he hasn't forgotten as the story goes on. He starts crying during his first conversation with his brothers.
Yeah.
So
I think this is more like a desire than like a reality. I'm sure he would like to. I'm sure he's like to forget his brothers and his father and stuff. And maybe he has times where, as he's gathering all this, you know, unmeasurable grain, he might have times where he goes long stretches where he doesn't think about it. But clearly, when he does think about it, it bothers him.
Yeah. And how could it not? As long as he's flesh and blood, there's no way that you simply get past having your brothers stab you in the back and go through all of the crap that you went that Joseph went through.
Yeah, and then when you name your next son, you know, God has blessed me in the land of my affliction, or prospered me in the land of my affliction. Yeah, land of your affliction. Yeah, how'd that happen? Like, I mean, it's still like, this is still your identity. Like, you still identify with these two things. One, like this father and these brothers, and you still identify this place that you're in, even though you're prospering, as the land of your affliction.
Mm-hmm.
And who's to blame for that affliction?
Yeah, right. Yep. Yeah, now that you mention it, both names really harken back to the two sources or two places of his affliction. The first one, Manasseh, the affliction he endured in his father's household because of his brothers. And his second son, Ephraim, the affliction that he's endured while he's in Egypt. He's betrayed first by his brothers, but he's betrayed a second time by Potiphar's wife, and then later by the cupbearer who forgets him for 2 years. So he's got a lot of affliction in his past just to simply forget it.
Yeah.
And this is something that it's a question I have, but there's really no answer to it. And that is, okay, put yourself in Joseph's shoes now. Now he now has so much power that he could basically do what he wants. He's not that far from Canaan. So if he wanted to make a trip there to see his family, or if he wanted to send, you know, messengers to tell his father and his brother Benjamin that he's still alive and everything that's happened, he could have done that too. So even though he has the power and the means to make contact with his family, even to go and see his family, he chooses not to. Which I think also indicates that this healing that he's talking about, or this forgetfulness that he's talking about, is not really there. It's more appearance than reality. Because if he were fully over this, then there would be nothing to impede his desire to seek reconciliation with his brothers. So it's almost like he's accepted that he's in Egypt and he's going to stay in Egypt, and he wants to forget about everything that he's gone through, but he can't quite do it. And he even gives his sons these names as sort of a farce to make it seem as if he's moved on, but clearly he hasn't. And I don't think that, and God doesn't want him to move on. That's another point to make here too. When his brothers show up in the next chapter, I expect that Joseph is not happy about it. He wants basically to be able to move forward. He can't, but he wants to. And he really doesn't, he kind of wants to forget that part of his past. He doesn't want to reconcile with his family. He doesn't want to deal with his brothers again. He wants to basically live this new life that he has in Egypt because things have turned out rather well for him. He has a wife. He has kids now. He has plenty of power, plenty of wealth. So it's like he has everything that you would think that he needs, and yet God's not going to let him sit there unreconciled to his family. He's going to force Joseph into a situation where he has to face what's gone on in the past and to seek reconciliation with his brothers.
Well, I mean, this whole thing, the whole 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine is just a strategy by God to bring about reconciliation. It's playing the long game for sure by God, but that's what he's doing.
Yeah, that's what he's doing. Joseph's not aware of that, but that's what God is up to.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to happen. That's what the rest of the chapter describes. In fact, there's the 7 years of plenty, the 7 years of famine, just like he had prophesied, but the famine is so severe, it doesn't affect just Egypt. It spreads from there and affects all the surrounding lands, which of course would include Canaan. And it says, the chapter finishes with this big wink at us. It says, the people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the earth. Earth here meaning that area. So that, like I said, that's a wink to us that something's about to happen. Because if it's not only affecting Egypt, but the surrounding lands, that means it's affecting Joseph's family. So this sets the stage for what's about to happen next. All right, so that was the end of chapter 41. Chapter 42 now opens with a completely different scene. You know, if this was a play, they'd close the curtain, they'd switch around the furniture, new actors would come on the stage because we're about to switch location and switch characters. So chapter 42 opens with kind of a humorous scenario. So here's Jacob, who's very old now, and here's his family, his sons, who just like Joseph, it's about 20 years has passed at this point since Joseph was sold. So he's about 38 years old now. And here's how the chapter opens. Jacob saw there was grain in Egypt. And so he says to his sons, "Why are you staring at one another?" So you got to see these brothers. And they're like looking at each other like, "What should we do?" And there's nothing even leading up to this. It just jumps right into this scene. So the curtain opens. There's Jacob. There's his sons. And he's like, "Why are you just looking at each other? Why are you staring at each other? We need to do something. Get off your butts. Look, we're out of food. There's no crops in the field. Everything's dead. We're all going to be starving to death. So let's do something." And then he goes on. He says, "Here, look, I've heard there's grain in Egypt. So go down there and buy us some from there. So we're going to live and not die." This is a very different Jacob than when we last left him. You know, two or three scenes before this, when we left Jacob, he had just heard about Joseph, that he thought Joseph was dead. He thought he'd been torn by a wild beast. And he's in deep grief and mourning. So that's where we left him 20 years prior to this moment. When we meet him again, I wouldn't say he's gotten past that, but he's certainly at a very different place now, although he's being afflicted just for a different reason. So this begins the first visit of the brothers to Egypt. There's going to be two visits of the brothers to Egypt, and this is the first time. So 10 of them, not 11, even though there are 11 sons left with Jacob, 10 of them load up their stuff. They get their donkeys, get their packs, get their money, and they set out for Egypt. It's about a week's travel, I think, something like that, down to Egypt to buy grain. But we learn one thing about Jacob from this opening scene. This is from verse 4. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, I am afraid that harm may befall him. Now, what does that tell you about Jacob?
That he is constantly playing favorites.
Yeah, right. Nothing's changed, right? Nothing's changed in that regard. We learned early in this story that he loved Joseph more than all his other sons. And after Joseph dies, supposedly dies, then Benjamin becomes his favorite. So he's afraid that something might happen to Benjamin. So he's still playing favorites. He's still coddling the son of his favorite wife, who is now long deceased. Well, this little detail is going to be significant when the brothers get down to Egypt. So let's pick up the story. They go down there to buy grain, along with a whole lot of other families. And in verse 6, it tells us Joseph was the ruler over the land, and he was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down to him with their faces to the ground.
Boom shakalaka.
Yeah, it took 20 years. It took 2 decades. But finally, the dream came to pass. So they're on their faces before Joseph. And Joseph recognizes them. So he knows who they are. 20 years have passed, but you know, it's like when you go back for your high school reunion after 20 years, yeah, you recognize most of the people. So he recognizes his brothers, but they have no idea who he is. It says he disguised himself to them and spoke to them harshly. So he recognizes them. They don't recognize him. He's disguised himself. No doubt Joseph looks completely different. He's dressed like an Egyptian. He speaks like an Egyptian. Of course, most of them, if not all the brothers, just assume he's dead by now. They've long given up the hope of having their evil deed reversed. So they assume he's dead. So that this is the last person they would assume they're talking to is Joseph. And he speaks to them harshly. We'll get back to that in a minute, but let's see what he says. He says, where have you come from? And they said, we came from Canaan to buy food. And at this point, it says, Joseph remembered the dreams which he had about them and says to them, you're spies. You've come to look at the undefended parts of the land. And we have this back and forth between them. They're like, no. We're only here to buy food. And then they give all of these details about themselves that they really shouldn't. It comes back to bite them later on. They say, we're brothers. We're all sons of one guy. And we're honest, which is hilarious. we're honest. We're not spies. And Joseph insists. He goes on, no. Look, you've come to spy out the, it says literally in Hebrew, the nakedness of the land, that like the, you know, the undefended parts of the land. And then they add even more details. They said, look, we're 12 brothers in all, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. The youngest is with our father today, and one is no more. I just love the irony of this. They're talking to Joseph. They're talking to a dead guy, they think. One is no more. So Joseph, Joseph will not let this rest. He says, look, you're spies. I'm going to test you. This is the test. He says, you're not going to go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Now, if they wouldn't have mentioned the youngest brother, there's no way that Joseph would have been able to say that. So they created these problems for themselves in more ways than one. So he says, send one of your brothers. One of you go get this youngest brother who supposedly exists and bring him back here. And the rest of you are going to stay in jail until this happens. And then he puts him in prison for 3 days. Let's stop there for a minute. Now, what's going on with Joseph? Why is he acting this way?
Well, it's one of two things or a mixture of both. I think there's the chance that he'd like to see Benjamin. So there is that. So he's devising a way to get Benjamin down there so he can see him.
That makes sense.
Since they share the same mother, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're all brothers, but he's a little bit, he's doubly his brother.
Right.
So there's that. And then I think there's also just a little bit of jerking these dudes around because you can.
Because you can, yeah. Because all the tables are turned now, right?
Oh, yeah. Watching them squirm, man.
So he's going to give them a little taste of their own medicine. Yeah, I suspect that both these are his motivations. He obviously wants to see Benjamin. In fact, later as the story unfolds, the second visit of the brothers to Egypt, when they do bring Benjamin, he lavishes gifts upon Benjamin, gives him twice as much as everybody else, singles him out for blessings. So, yeah, Joseph, because he is his only full brother, has a lot of love for Benjamin. And of course, Benjamin had zero to do with all the bad stuff that happened to Joseph. Benjamin wasn't even there. So he, you know, there's no grievance that Joseph has against Benjamin, quite the opposite. But he is in a position to jerk his brothers around and possibly to simply find out, you know, if they are telling the truth. Because the last experience that Joseph had with his brothers is probably the same way that he views those brothers.
Yeah, well, I mean, is it possible that he even thinks, like, look, maybe, I mean, did you guys off Benjamin too? And he wants to know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
I mean, if they did that to Joseph, well, yeah, think of it this way. Okay, so Joseph's looking at 10 brothers. Now, where's the 11th? Because he knows that he was his father's favorite, and it doesn't take much deduction to assume that with Joseph gone, Benjamin was going to become his father's favorite, which we know is the case. Joseph did not know that, but we know that. And if his brothers treated him the way they did, who's to say that they didn't do the same to Benjamin, right?
Right.
So maybe he thinks, yeah, that they did to Benjamin the same thing that they did to him.
And perhaps if he finds out that they did to Benjamin the same thing they did to him, this doesn't go well.
Yeah, they're going to be in prison more than 3 days.
Yeah.
They might not ever come out. Yeah, so he's testing them, no doubt, and jerking them around, for sure, and probably also trying to figure out a way to get Benjamin down there. He probably never wanted any of this to happen. Maybe he did. Maybe I'm reading this too negatively. But he seemed at least partially content with how everything was going up to this point. And now he's confronted with his brothers, and he remembers the dream that he had, which has to also open up new possibilities in his mind. I'm thinking that probably by this time he assumed that the dreams were just visions of youth, which were really never going to come to pass. But now they have. There's his brothers bowing down to him in fulfillment of the dreams. And now he has to figure out what he's going to do with his brothers. So he puts them in jail for 3 days. And a little psychological warfare going on here. Then he either changes his mind, or maybe the whole thing was a ruse to begin with. I don't know, but he brings him out on the third day, and he says, "I fear God. I'm a respectable ruler. So here's what I'm going to do. If you're honest, if you are as you say you are, then we're going to keep one of you here in prison, and the rest of you can carry your grain back to your households, because I know they're starving to death. And then bring your youngest brother to me so that I'll know that you're not lying and you won't die. And And then we, you know, we presume that at that point he would let the brother that he's kept in prison free. So that's Joseph's plan. Now, I think one of the most revealing verses in this whole narrative is verse 21 of chapter 42. So after all this goes on, the 3 days in prison, the accusation that they're spies, Joseph saying he's going to keep one of them in prison while they go back. So all this bad stuff that they had no idea was going to happen has happened. And here's their reaction. This I think is extremely telling, not only about the brothers, but just about all of us in general. It says, this is the brothers speaking to each other. They say, truly, we are guilty concerning our brother, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, and yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us.
This dude's been carrying around some guilt for quite some time.
Yes, they have. Big time. That's what I think is fascinating about this. 20 years have gone by, and yet when things fall apart, when they are going through this whole ordeal, that is the first thing that comes to mind. All of this is happening because of what we did to Joseph. So yeah, it's Luther once, what was this phrase that Luther used? Something about, old guilt gathers no rust.
Nice.
German proverb, which I think is true. Old guilt gathers no rust. Guilt has a way of, it's like a ghost that haunts you. And we've talked about this before too, like when you're living with this immense guilt, it tends to be the lens through which you interpret anything good or bad that happens to you. So that if anything good happens to you, it's easy to be suspicious of it, as if it's just going to be temporary, and it's actually just a disguise for something bad about to happen. Or when something bad happens to you, it's always because like it's a punishment because of what you did wrong. And that's where the brothers are. They interpret all of this as nothing more than punishment for what they did to Joseph years ago. Now the good news is that eventually they're going to realize that they had forgiveness all along. Joseph tells them this at the end of this whole story, that they had forgiveness all along. So to stop beating themselves up and to believe the forgiveness that it gives to them. And it's the same message for us. The old guilt that gathers no rest for us is guilt that really doesn't even exist.
Right.
That's the beauty of the gospel, is because it's non-existent, because Christ has assumed it into himself, all of our guilt, all of our sin, all of our death. He's taken it away, so it's no longer our guilt. It's no longer our sin. It belongs to Christ. It no longer belongs to us. And because it belongs to him, it has ceased to exist, because he's buried it in his own grave. And when he left that grave, he left the sin behind, left the guilt behind. So old guilt gathers no rest. Well, there is really no old guilt, because that guilt has been atoned for by the blood of Christ.
Yeah, there's going to be some sweet absolution going on, but it's not like this absolution where it's just I forgive you, but like you're saying, it's I've already forgiven you.
Yeah, like, yeah, it's a done deal.
It's over. God is not just willing and able to forgive you. He already has.
Mm-hmm.
The his goal is just to get you into a knowledge of that.
Yeah, the mistake that people think is that they imagine that God is just waiting to forgive us. He's ready to forgive us. He's willing to forgive us. All we have to do is take a step toward him, or believe in him, or do something anyway in order that it may become a reality. But the truth is, it already is a reality. Christ on the cross absolved the world. It's done. We are forgiven. All sin is atoned for. All guilt is atoned for. God was not only willing and ready, he accomplished it. So it's a reality. into which God invites us by faith to enter and to receive the benefits of that.
Amen. And we are done. Out of time. All right. That's a good place to end. We're going to get some of that tasty absolution, I think, next week. I think we'll get there. We'll get there.
Yes, sir. We will. We are on our way.
We will get there. So, guys, thanks for hanging out. If you want to check out more stuff, you can go over to ChristHoldFast.org. If you would like to support the program, the blog, the other podcasts, the city events, we'd appreciate it if you did. You can go to ChristHoldFast.org/support. And thank you to those who have done that. We will see you next week.